Sorry, I cut you off.
No, that was the end of it.
Okay,
I couldn't even find my words. I was actually quite happy you cut me off.
Good, I'm glad I did it.
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up, and tried to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538, and with me in the studio, it's my two favorite people to talk about sports with. It's Neil Payne.
Hey, Chad.
Hi, Neil. Neil, a sports writer and editor at 538. How you doing today, Neil?
Doing good. Now that you said that I was one of your favorite people to talk with
sports
about.
Are we the only people you talk sports with, actually?
Oh, don't diminish this compliment from Chad.
Also with us in the studio, it's Kate Fagan, ESPN W columnist, and Hot Takedown's special liaison for Bryce Harper contract
over $400 million for sure.
You think you're feeling good about that?
I feel good. He's going to bust that barrier.
You're Hot Takedown special liaison, so shouldn't you be trying to save us money?
Oh, are we paying?
You're paying.
I see.
Oh, wow.
So lowball the guy. I know other GMs want $400 million.
He's a position player, everybody. Come on.
And, you know, it's really about the culture of the locker room here. That's what he's going to be getting. That's worth at least $50 million.
Okay. I'm on it.
Good.
Hi, Chad.
Hi. Great to see you. All right. On today's show, we're going to do something a little different on Hot Takedown this week. We're trying to make Hot Takedown both shorter and deeper. Those might sound like contradictory things, but we think we can pull it off. So we're going to try a new structure. And so on today's show, at the top, we're going to play a little round of Should We Have Seen This Coming about the Nashville Predators' two-game win sprint to tie up the Stanley Cup Final. It's now 2-2, the Preds and the Penguins. So we'll talk about how it got to 2-2 after it was 2-0. And then we're going to go very deep into what the first two games of the NBA Finals tell us about the NBA's competitive balance. The Warriors have been incredible. Does that mean that something is broken with the NBA because they've been so much better than purportedly the next best team on the other side? And then finally, our significant digit about a man's untethered 3,000-foot climb into the sky. Importantly, listeners, we want to hear from you about this new structure. Email us at podcasts@538.com. Let us know if you missed the old one, if you think this new one, you know, feels like it brings out the true essence.
But really mind yourself that you're not just upset that there's change. You know,
really
make sure that you've cleared that hurdle within yourself and you're not just mad that we changed something. Right, Chad?
Yes. And if you are just mad, direct those emails to Kate.
Senior Bryce Harper,
it's
correspondent.
It's kate.fagan@gmail.com.
All right, let's talk about hockey. After two games of the Stanley Cup Final, the Predators were down 2-0 and staring at a quick exit from their first Stanley Cup, right, Neil?
Right.
The first one ever. Their goalie looked bad, Pekka Rinne, the goalie we've talked about many times on this show. And the offense looked stymied, and one of their best players was being mocked for his bad breath. Did you see this?
Listerine.
I love that P.K. Subban brought in mouthwash to the game.
A bag full
you don't
of
see
Listerine.
That. Yeah, Sidney Crosby. You don't see that every day.
All right, but now they're tied 2-2, the Predators are, after a 4-1 victory in game four. So my question for you guys, and Kate, let me start with you.
I love when you start first with me. This is great.
Should we have seen this coming? Two wins after looking bad. Is this surprising to you?
Well, I guess the part where we assume that they looked bad is where there's some disagreement, because they looked pretty good in the first two games, outplaying the Pittsburgh Penguins by most metrics, except the one that most of us agree is the most important,
which scoreboard.
Is the scoreboard and also goalie. And I think the question mark going forward was like, okay, we'd seen enough from Rene throughout the season to know that he was capable of being the guy that would bring the Predators a title, but he wasn't for the first two games. So I think we could have seen it coming, because overall the Nashville Predators were playing better than
the Penguins. It was kind of an interesting flip of what we had seen from the Predators during the season, in the sense that they really didn't do that well in terms of possession or outshooting teams, but they outshot the Penguins 64-39 in the first two games, and they relied on their goaltending. And like you said, Rinne was uncharacteristically bad in those first two games. But then also coming back home to Nashville, the Predators, through now having won the past two games, they're 9-1 in the playoffs. playoffs at home. And so this is something for them where we talked about this a while ago, where home ice is kind of a questionable thing in the NHL playoffs because things are very random and it doesn't seem like even home teams get a boost in the playoffs. But they are having one of the best playoff home performances we've seen. And so it might be slightly more likely that they have some kind of home ice advantage than the typical hockey team, maybe.
Well, it's hard because also the Pittsburgh Penguins' home ice advantage throughout the regular season was extraordinary as well. And so these are two teams who seem to dispel the myth, not the myth, but the fact that NHL home ice doesn't matter as much in the postseason. So I'm almost like, okay, they're both good at home. Let's throw that out and actually look at how the Nashville Predators have dominated them in most meaningful categories.
Yeah, and you kind of expect that type of thing to regress to the mean, and eventually, you know, you would expect Nashville to break through. But I don't know, maybe that Game 7 being in Pittsburgh is sort of the trump card that will determine who gets to hoist the cup.
So it sounds like both of you are saying we should have seen this coming, or at least not be surprised that it has come. One of the things that I've been thinking about since we talk about the randomness of hockey so often is it to me, it runs the risk of cheapening wins or cheapening when somebody turns something around or a team turns it around. And so, Neil, I'm curious, like, what would in hockey you not see coming? You know, if the worst team in hockey won 2 against the Penguins, is that something we also should have seen coming? Like, where are the limits of expectation and surprise?
Well, I think the limits are especially kind of blurred now in the NHL after the lockout because of the way that there's been the salary cap and the teams are so sort of evenly matched. I would have been not surprised at all if during the 80s, the Gretzky-era Oilers just, you know, blew the doors off people. That would have been not surprising because of the way that they played, the way the game was kind of tailored to them. Now, I do feel like, you know, once you get this deep in the playoffs, there isn't a lot that's surprising because you can kind of point to it and say, we didn't know what we were going to see in the first place. And so now, you know, it's kind of confirmation by confusion, I guess.
All right, let's leave it there. That's a little headline segment in the new Hot Takedown. Again, let us know what you think. We're trying this new structure out. So, from hockey to the NBA, from a final to the finals.
Yes, very important distinction, as we learned last week.
The first two games at the NBA Finals have been thrilling and absolute blowouts by the end of the game. I have, like, yelped with surprise at various plays that have happened, various dribbles, various
Curry passes, pull-up threes. No-look passes.
Not just Curry. I mean, the Cavs are putting on a clinic with half-court passes, and there was one LeBron bomb to Kyrie, and Kyrie basically, like, sealed off his defender like he was a wide receiver.
It was like a wide receiver, yeah.
Anyway, so the games have been, I think, really good despite being really boring by the final 45 minutes of them. And that they've been blowouts have sort of made us here at Hot Takedown wonder whether the NBA should be worried about competitive balance, which is that if you have the two best teams playing and these are 20-something point blowouts by the end of the game, does that suggest that something in the NBA is broken? And before I get to the two of you, I want to just listen to Adam Silver talk to Mike and Mike about this earlier last week, in which he's talking about whether Kevin Durant going to the Warriors is to blame.
I heard Kevin Durant say something like this the other day. I think it's, first of all, a little unfair to him to blame him for the lack of so-called competitive balance at the moment in the league. I mean, he could have only impacted one team had he stayed in Oklahoma City or gone somewhere else. There's no doubt that that team would have been better, but it wouldn't have changed the fortunes for 27 other teams in the league. It's just hard for me to fathom how there becomes this perception that at the moment there are only two teams that are truly competitive in this league. I just don't believe it. And I think you're going to see these things have a way of working themselves out over time. I mean, Kawhi Leonard was the 15th pick in the draft. Isaiah Thomas was the 60th pick in the draft. Draymond Green was the 35th pick in the draft. And we have a great draft class coming up. I mean, do we have the perfect balance right now? I'm not sure. But, you know, we'll respond. I mean, I do care, of course, about competitive balance. You want competitive games. But I thought we had a great regular season.
So this is where I'm trying to pull in my own personal reins from not springing to the conclusion that there's a huge issue with the NBA, even though a part of me is drifting in that direction. I do tend to lean toward what Adam Silver is saying, like things will work themselves out eventually. Like, obviously, it's easier to bet on the fact that the NBA is going to figure it out and we're not going to see some kind of like slippery slope toward a UConn women's basketball future. for the NBA. That seems the more likely outcome. But when you look at the NBA and this question about, like, was it about Kevin Durant leaving the Oklahoma City Thunder and going to the Warriors? No, that was like step nine in a process that has led the NBA to where it is now. You can go as far back to, and you could probably go farther, but we'll go as far back to like Kevin Garnett breaking the bank and changing the rules about what a player can get. And then, I mean, there's been steps along the way that lead us to the point where then Kevin Durant and goes make a super team that's even greater than the super team of the Miami Heat.
Yeah, like to suggest that it's Kevin Durant's fault, I totally agree with Adam Silver that that's wrong because he can only make the decisions that he can within the constraints that have been set up for him. Now, do I think that everything about the way that talent is allocated in the NBA is sort of, incentivized a team like this to eventually emerge? Yes. I mean, you know, you have to give the Warriors credit for drafting the players that they did, especially like Curry was not a surefire future Hall of Famer coming out of college. You know, Draymond Green was a second round pick. They made great choices. And we've talked about this with the draft in particular, that some team is going to have a lot of really valuable draft picks, overshoot the the average projection for a lot of those draft picks. So end up with a team that's far better than, you know, you would expect even from the wealth of draft picks that they have, which is, by the way, what all the tanking teams are kind of aiming to try to be, that team that has a bunch of valuable picks and gets lucky with those picks. But then you have this other mechanism whereby, and because there's a maximum salary for players, so there isn't a lot of incentive, you know, monetarily for them to go to some team that doesn't have a superstar. And also you have players that they think about their legacies. I tweeted about this the other day about how, you know, for all the obsession that we've given to players that we judge them by how many rings they win, and that is sort of the final arbiter of how good they are at the end of the day, why would we not think that they would make decisions based on maximizing their chances of winning a championship? And that's exactly what Kevin Durant did. So it's all of, like you said, Kate, it's like the culmination of decades of policy by the NBA that has kind of created this atmosphere whereby something like this was inevitable.
So I want to just point out, too, that what the Warriors have done has been operating very much within the norm of NBA policies, which is to say what the Nets did, five years ago now, I think, when they had Pierce and Garnett and Darren Williams and Brooke Lopez, and they broke the salary cap in a way that they wanted to pay the tax on top. That seems like more aberrant behavior than what the Warriors are doing. And so I think it's important to say, to Neil's point, like not only are the Warriors, or Kevin Durant and the Warriors, playing within the rules that the NBA abides, they're not even trying to stretch them that far. You know, they're doing normal things around delaying contract re-ups and things like that.
Now, the one thing that is abnormal that we've probably talked about all season ever since Kevin Durant put pen to paper is we haven't seen a player who is kind of at the beginning of his prime vulture a ring like this and kind of jump to an already stacked, already existent super team, to be honest, even if they came by it, the right way, like Chad was alluding to. Usually you would see, and maybe the 2008 Celtics are kind of the first example of this in recent memory, of some veterans coming together at the end of their primes or the beginning of their decline phase and getting the band together for one last push for a championship. Then you saw with LeBron, maybe it's a player at the kind of in the middle of his prime or the end of his prime with Chris Bosh and Dwayne Wade. Then now we're seeing a player at the beginning of his prime, and that's kind of the question of like, when does that stop? And are we going to see, because of the incentives that basically say, yeah, you should do this if you want to win, and there's no monetary reason not to, at least nothing meaningful, just kind of a small difference in money. You know, why wouldn't we have seen this before might be the more pressing question.
When you talk about incentives, a huge chunk of that is the pursuit for an NBA title. And a lot of factors, I think, have gone into the value of an NBA title skyrocketing. And some of it is just modern technology and the way we can nonstop discuss it and the way that actually having one impacts your individual value in a new way, and like this discussion of legacy. And so that's part of the incentive. And I did earlier make the comparison to UConn women's basketball. And because I've written about this, when you look at UConn women's basketball and why people continue going there, it is because of similar incentives, legacy, and an ability to actually win that cannot be matched elsewhere. Because if you want a title in women's college basketball, you pretty much have to go to UConn. That was not the case previously in the NBA. And now it seems as if you're playing by these certain incentives and winning is one of them, there's basically only any given year, like, two teams you can go to. And then the added factor to me is, like, that the NBA and the way that the structure is in determining a champion is not luck at all. And so at least with UConn, you can see occasionally when they're down.
Yeah, a buzzer beater.
One game. I mean, Mississippi State is not going to beat UConn in a seven-game series. And so the NBA is, if it's trending in the way that its incentives are doled out, it also has a playoff structure that makes it impossible for, like, a random chance of upheaval.
The culture of the NBA seems to have changed a little bit, too, in the sense that now people are trying to maximize efficiency in a way that maybe in the 80s the best players are trying to become the guy for their team. And so there wasn't the super team idea because you wanted to be the superstar on the team. And now Durant realizes that with the way the NBA is played, he was in Oklahoma City, right? And he was the superstar.
And it's also almost like you can't hide anymore. Like at the even 8 years ago, like, Monta Ellis could put up big numbers and a mainstream fan would just think Monta Ellis is a superstar. So there was more of an incentive in the 80s, I think, to put up big numbers and be a star on any team because you couldn't actually dive into those numbers and be like, well, actually, he's not an efficient player and he's not as good as we think he is.
Yeah, exactly. Like, nowadays, nobody is giving you credit for being like a Bernard King on, you know, kind of a struggling team, but you become like a folk hero for scoring 30 points a game despite playing with a bunch of scrubs. I think it comes down to a general trend of devaluing the regular season in general, where this happens not just in the NBA but in pretty much all sports, and it does feel like it's trending more toward devaluing over time, where we just don't care what happens during those 82 games between November and April, and we just sort of bide our time through that. And part of that is, you know, teams are resting players during those. You have tanking at the other end of the spectrum. So I think, like, that is the flip side of it, is we've elevated championships to mean everything at the expense of, you know, anything else in the game, and we've devalued the regular season and any kind of accomplishments that happen there, and that's part of the incentivizing of kind of creating what we see now.
Let me just ask a question to make sure that we aren't getting ahead of ourselves here. A lot of this conversation is based off of a great regular season from the Warriors, a perfect run so far through the postseason from the Warriors, but really it's about two games in which they have been playing at a pace and at a skill level that the Cavs have not been able to keep up with. Are we rushing to a conclusion about how strong the Warriors are, or the imbalance in the NBA, based on too little information?
Meaning that we could be sitting here a week from now and the series is
tied.
I mean, meaning that last year in the playoffs, the Warriors blew the Cavaliers out for two games and then went on to lose a series. Now, everyone keeps saying, well, they didn't have Kevin Durant, and that's what's added to this year's team. And I think on the face of it, that is a very rational argument, right? You think to yourself, well, if the well goes dry, they now have someone who is so good that it's unlikely that Kevin Durant will also go dry when Klay Thompson and Steph Curry and whoever else goes dry. And Curry looks like Curry again. There's lots of reasons.
I guess when we talk about, well, how are we looking at and, quote-unquote, predicting the next few games of this series, you're inevitably going to wander into some sort of, like, either personal feeling about it or hot take-ville, because you're trying to make a prediction about the future. All I can say from having watched all of last year's series and having watched the first two games of this series is that there does not seem to be a statistical, competitive, X's and O's shift that the Cavaliers can make that I can actually play out in my mind and see it resulting in a competitive shift in this series. Like, everything I think that the Cavs did last year, if I did it again, you already see the counterpunch that the Warriors have. And so you're relying a little bit on the belief of magic, which we've seen, so it's not as if it's impossible. It's just all you can say is, well, I guess magic could happen. But otherwise, everything I'm seeing on the basketball court tells me this is not going to be a repeat of last year.
Also, I mean, there's a reason why we were raving about the comeback that the Cavs made last year is because we hadn't seen anything like that happen, especially on the NBA Finals stage, ever before. It was, I think you can make a very strong case that it was the greatest comeback given the circumstances, who they were playing, and the stage it was taking place on in NBA history. And now you see that, you know, those Warriors have, like you said, Chad, they've only added Kevin Durant since then, and it's only made them more impossible to defend against. And so we're asking for something that had never happened before to happen again against an even stronger opponent. And so that's why I think that, you know, any kind of harking back to last year, it's fair because it is recent and we have seen it, but also it's, you know, asking for something very unlikely to happen.
Okay, so I want to bring us back to the central question around whether the NBA should be worried about its competitive balance. It seems like all of us think that it's certainly not on Kevin Durant that the Warriors are super good. It's not even on the Warriors. It seems like we think that everything's above board of what's taken place, and the Warriors got lucky with certain draft picks and whatnot. But I think the question is, has the Warriors' success shown weaknesses in the way the NBA creates its rule structure? Are there things that the Warriors should be prompting the Rules Committee or whatever committee it is within the NBA to think about around the way that teams are assigned draft picks, let's say? That seems like not the way what the Warriors have been exploiting. That's more of the tanking conversation. Around the way that salary caps work, if you have won, let's say, a certain number of games, that would be radical. The idea that your salary cap depends on how good you were, that would really drag teams to the center. Or are we saying, and this is the UConn example, these finals have been, the last two iterations of these finals between these two teams have been very highly rated. This is good for the NBA. It sucks for the Wizards, who are never going to be able to break through, or the Grizzlies, who didn't break through, not just because of the Warriors. And that's how it's going to be, because we look back fondly on the era of the Celtics and Lakers, and like that's what grandkids are talked to about, and the same will happen for the Warriors.
Yeah, I mean, the NBA is not exactly known in its history for having a lot of parity compared with the other sports. There was a period of time where you could kind of look back decades and the same group of teams, the Lakers, Celtics, Bulls, Pistons, you know, whomever, had monopolized like decades worth of championships. And so I don't know if some of this is just an artifact of us kind of coming of age now. You know, when we were kids, we loved Michael Jordan and we kind of appreciated that the Bulls dominated, but maybe now it's like, oh, well, we wish that, you know, other teams would have a chance. Gosh, Warriors, why don't you, show a little competitive balance? I do think there's some cognitive dissonance there compared with history. And, you know, this isn't going to be, I crunched some numbers on this for, you know, our ELO rating. We talked about this, that the Warriors were most likely going to become the highest rated team of all time, and they did after game one with that blowout win. But even if they were to sweep and win the next two games by 3 points, just, you know, kind of giving them that much credit on the road, they would still only have the third widest gap between the rating of the champion and that of the second team, the finals loser that season.
So that again?
So
you mean ELO rating?
Right, exactly. The difference
What about scoring margin difference?
Well, I don't know about scoring margin difference, but all I'm saying is that
process
in terms
all those
of
numbers
the,
right
yeah,
now.
Right. In terms of the kind of on paper talent differential between the NBA champion and the runner up, this would not even be the number one. The Lakers and the Sixers in 2001, there was a bigger gap, and the Sixers were the best team in the East that year. And you could kind of say, like, who else were the Lakers going to go through? They beat the Kings, they beat the Spurs, they swept both of those teams. So, and in 1971, the Bucks ran roughshod through the league as well. So we've seen other examples of teams that were, you know, in the neighborhood of being as good as the Warriors, and also had a bigger gap between them and the team that they beat in the finals, I guess is the point that I'm saying. So if we want to say competitive balance is broken now, it's been broken at various other points throughout the history of the game, and it always corrected itself. The Lakers won three championships in the early 2000s, but eventually, because of infighting with Shaq and Kobe, and Shaq getting older, and you know, veterans leaving, all of these things, and Phil Jackson kind of stirring that pot too much, that team disintegrated. And so we're kind of bracing ourselves for the Warriors to be this unbeatable team for years and years to come. I don't think we ever truly appreciate how quickly the fortunes of different teams can kind of rise and fall.
And this gets back to Adam Silver's point in the clip we heard, that like the question being, will this play itself out almost in a natural way? Will it, as Neil just said, course correct? I don't think the competitive balance in the NBA has ever been something to write home about, but what it has always seemed to have had, and perhaps this is like rose-colored rearview mirror here, is in the same way as like Marvel superhero comics, like it has had two-star teams. And at the end of any season, all that matters is that those superhero teams, whether they were as superhero as the current Warriors, were in an epic clash at the end, to carry on this metaphor. And there was some belief in the minds of viewers of this clash that either of these super teams could win. And that's where I think there's been a bit of a division with this NBA Finals, is that I don't believe that for the first time in the history of my personally watching the NBA.
But, and I'm now entering into my own hot take territory, but I do wonder from a sort of business and fan audience question, there does seem to me to have been a shift from a team-based affinity within the NBA to a narrative-based affinity, right? I am tracking Russell and... and so to me, the idea is that this is bad for the game is not really tenable. Because if the game is fueled by narrative, and the narrative of the Warriors world beaters is still fresh, right? In 4 years, maybe then we need to have this conversation. But the idea that because it was the same two teams in the finals for 3 years in a row, finals that were very highly rated, including an incredible comeback last year.
Yeah, very competitive the first two of the three, and maybe, you know, there's still time for the third.
Right, and so like this all seems like good for the NBA. And if I were Adam Silver, I'd be sleeping really happily at night.
Because all you're going to see as a countermeasure to the Warriors superhero team is our secondary characters who are tired of being secondary characters, like prime example right now being Chris Paul, having conversations off screen saying, we need to be the upstart team that can then make the Warriors the villain.
And the rumors that Paul will go to San Antonio, and that just creates a new
right.
superhero
so
duo or
there's
whatever.
There's two questions about whether, like, do I think it's bad for business for the NBA? No. Am I concerned that there is, like, the last dying gasps of anybody pretending that the NBA has any sort of team-based competitive league that we should really invest in for 82 games? That's the part that I think is in its dying gasps.
Yeah, I wonder if this is just kind of the middle stages of this endless arms race that sees all of the talent of the kind of elite talent in the league just coalesce into like four teams or however many teams. And the problem is like, on the like you said, the it's good for business right now. I don't know how good for business it is or what the point of having teams be in kind of these outposts where there aren't any great players ever will be down the road. And you know...
Wait, do you then at that point...
No,
does
I disagree with
are they the Washington Generals?
I
you think
the
so?
Premise.
You think like the Milwaukee Bucks 10 years from now?
The tanking draft structure is such that those teams are still going to get number one draft picks. They may not last very long, but...
That's what I'm saying. Will Milwaukee ever be the team that creates and draws a super team, even if they draft the next LeBron
James?
Warriors
well, they
sucks
did.
Not
they have Giannis.
But they're Golden State.
What do you mean?
There's a lot of upside to Golden State that
to
will never
in the
exist.
Bay Area.
That will never exist in eight NBA
sure.
franchises.
I mean, Cleveland, you know, is not exactly the place that lots of people want to go. But
yeah, they were fortunate to have LeBron James
sure.
be born
right.
in the vicinity.
Let's leave it there. Maybe we'll pick up this conversation.
We didn't solve it, though.
Oh, I feel very resolute in my belief.
Oh, okay.
I'm glad you do.
All right, let's leave it there and move on to our significant digit. When a telling number from the world of sports is delivered to us, I'm bringing it this week. Hmm. Our significant digit is 3,300 feet. That is the length of the climb that Alex Hunold, a rock climber, did, which is he did a route on El Capitan, which is a very famous climbing wall in Yosemite. He did it without ropes, without any equipment. He got on the rock. He climbed for 3,300 feet.
Vertically?
And then he summited.
Like just...
It's 3,300 feet total. I think it's 2,750 feet tall.
Holy
from,
cow.
From base.
what pops into my mind is I want to know if there's any way to statistically analyze like the percentage chance along each step of his route of danger.
Of him dying?
Yeah.
So they're like, different. So each pitch. So I'm really going to.
There you go.
I'm
geek
be
out
going
for,
here. All right. So rock climbing is usually done in pitches, which is the length of the rope before you reset the rope because the rope is only so long. Now, Hunold wasn't using rope at all, so pitches are a little bit funny. But this is usually sketched out as though it's in pitches. And so each pitch has a different rating usually. And so the Washington Post has a really good graphic that we'll link to on Hot Takedown's page about sort of different parts of the rock. And like at one point there was a vertical hold that was the width of a pencil. And so you're really gripping on like that. At other parts it was slabby, mm-hmm. which is when you're sort of leaning into the wall and just – and there aren't footholds that are like nubs. Instead, you're just putting friction on your feet against the wall. And so the thing with Hunold, so Hunold's famous for mm-hmm. being a free solo climber, which is this idea that he can climb faster with less mental energy expended because he doesn't have to worry about where he's putting his gear into the rock to build the protection or the carabiners, basically, that he'll sling the rope into. Mm-hmm. And so he did this whole thing in 4 hours, which is incredible. It usually takes 4 days.
Wow.
And didn't have to sleep on the rock, didn't have to go through any of that stuff that can sometimes drain someone's energy because you don't get a great sleep while you're hanging off the cliff side. And so what Hunold did is remarkable, but also I'm not sure if it's rock climbing necessarily, and this is what I want to talk to you guys a little bit about, was, you know, a lot of the write-ups have called it pure climbing because it didn't have any of this rope or any of these protections. But to me, it's actually a mutant aberrant form of it because the pure version of this sport is one that requires all that mental energy and trying to figure out where to place the protection. And so I was curious for you guys, like, if someone could run really fast at in football, but without any pads on, let's say, right? Like, is that something that feels like it's native and germane to the same sport as everyone else is playing?
Well, isn't it more of an applicable comparison to say that if I think a marathoner could run faster barefoot and naked?
Sure, couldn't break the two-hour mark that we were talking about with Christy not too long ago.
Yeah, I mean, I guess because it... Even if a football player was great without pads, maybe for a game before they're injured. Whereas when I think rock climbing, I actually think he's even purer of a version of rock climbing. Because I'm assuming the first rock climber ever did it because they had to get somewhere. And they didn't have ropes with them. And they just were like desperate to get to a higher elevation.
Sure. They weren't doing this kind of rock climbing, though. They might have been like an alpinist who like... scaled mountains, for example, at first and had tricky passages. But what this is very technical rock climbing from start to finish. And that used to be done with, they would bolt ladders or aid protection into the wall. And so at first it wasn't what's called free climbing, which is when you don't leave anything in the rock. At first they would bolt all the stuff in the rock in order to get up. And then it was free climbing, which is when you put the gear in and then you take it away when you're done. Mm-hmm. And now it's this free soloing, which has been done for a while, but never at this technical level. This was what's called a 512D climb in difficulty. It goes up to 515A, and there's lots of steps in between. But like at my gym, let's say, I climb, like, if I'm lucky, a 510C or D on a good day. And there's like, I couldn't even begin the climb that he did. And he did it without a rope. And so the question, too, is like whether death is part of the purity of rock climbing, because if he falls, he's dead. I don't know. It's very interesting to me.
I'm fascinated by free soloing from also a lot of different, like, emotional human levels. Like
the mental side of it.
Yeah.
Side of it.
I don't know. Are you supposed to? I've read stuff with him, and he said, like, I've just accepted that death is a possibility. And I'm like, I don't know how you get to that place.
Yeah. This wasn't the first time he climbed right. this route. And so he'd been practicing, and this had been on his bucket list for years, apparently.
I think they should make LeBron dunk over a 3,000-foot chasm. I think
we could make everything about basketball if we had to.
Yeah.
That's true. All right. Thank you for humoring my climbing interests. That'll do it for this week's show. Okay, Fagan, how's that Bryce Harper contract coming?
I got him down to 380.
Ooh.
Feel good about it.
Dealing.
Yeah.
Neil Payne, thanks for talking about sports.
Thanks, Chad.
Our podcast producer is Katie Ferguson. We got production assistance from Tony Chow and Martin Onebu. Our intern, we have a new intern.
Yay.
Guys. Alice Wilder is here with us for the summer. Very excited to have you, Alice. Thanks for the help on the show. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We would love to hear what you think, especially about this shorter, tighter deeper structure that we're doing. Find us on your favorite podcasting app. We're on iTunes, of course, as well. Subscribe at iTunes.com/538. While you're there, be sure to review and or rate the show. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.